Stop that ship! Blast them!
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the latest episode of Armor Party. I am your host, Mike Forrester, wishing you a happy February and hoping you're making it through the dog days of winter with an optimistic look at all of the amazing Star Wars coming in the next few months. I absolutely loved the costumes in Book of Boba Fett. I'm in a few of the build groups, most notably the Cad Bane build group on Facebook, which is moderated by past Armor Party guests, Terry Chu and Luke Daly. And watching them bring this costume to life in seemingly record speed is so damn cool to see. I'm headed to the Galactic Star Cruiser within the next 2 weeks and cannot wait to get inspired and lose myself to 3 days on the Halcyon. So check back in for a full report in early March. I want to also give a special shout out to our recent Armor Party guest, Justin Sonfield, for becoming the 501st Legion Commanding Officer, the head honcho. It is a title well-earned, well-deserved. His passion for costuming and experience will surely be exciting to watch as he helps direct over 11,000 members worldwide to continue to bring Star Wars to life. So give his episode a listen to learn more about his journey in nerddom and what he has in store for us if you are a part of these costuming clubs. Now, if you're looking to gear up for a trip to Batuu or Celebration and do kind of a non-hero costume, my next guest will be the answer to the questions you are seeking. So turn up that volume, get out those sanding blocks, put on that respirator, and let's start the show. Enjoy. My next guest is a talented costumer, artist, and certainly a Sith of the Stitch. Her inspired designs invoke that vintage feeling of the late 70s, but with the modern cuts that make you feel oh so rebellious. Her commission slots go faster than a pod racer, but with the details as good as hers, you know each project is as focused as the Force. Joining us from the Southern Continental in Georgia to talk about her shop, Gabbercrete, and all things costuming, I am very happy to be splitting seams with Roba Emma herself, Emma Swanson. Welcome to the Armor Party.
Thanks for having me.
How are you? What's going on?
Oh, I've been sketching and sewing all day, so the usual.
Well, I'm super excited to have you on the show, Emma. Since I've gotten into this really dedicated fan community of Star Wars makers and builders and costumers, your stuff, the Gabbercrete stuff, the jackets, just really the whole vibe that you put off and both on your personal page with your custom builds and your you know, personal costumes and the stuff that you've done, I'm like, I got to get you on the show. I'm a huge fan. I would love to know a little bit about your background. Like, what is your Star Wars story? How did this all get out of hand for you?
How did I get into Star Wars? So I had like a brush with Star Wars before I ever got into Star Wars. I was really little and I was in an outdoor drive-in theater with my family and we had already watched like 2 movies and it was really late and I was super tired. One of them was, of course, Twister because it was that time.
Sure.
And the opening crawl for episode 4 started to scroll across the scene. The screen, and my dad goes, "Oh, Emma, you're going to like this one." And I fell asleep before the movie had even started because I was so tired. So like flash forward a few years, I had won a library contest and my prize was that I got to pick out a book from like a selection that they had laid out. And like none of them looked all that interesting to me. I finally like literally settled on this Star Wars book. It was The Uncertain Path, which was a book in the Jedi Apprentice series. And I was like, I'll just get this one. I know Star Wars is cool and people like Star Wars, so maybe it will be good. And like, I guess I must have seen episode 1 because I read it and I was like, I thought Qui-Gon died in that movie. Why is he alive in this book? Like, when I didn't understand it at all. And so even then I didn't get into it. And then it was the summer before fourth and fifth grade, and I randomly picked up this book again and I read it and I understood finally this is a prequel to that movie. I was totally hooked. Like, I needed to read the rest of the series immediately. And it's like one of my fondest memories was ordering these books on like our library catalog. And I would come to back to the library and I would see the stack of books like wrapped up behind the librarian's desk, like ready to go for me. And that's like that energy and that excitement that I was going to get to read the next book. And that's like, that's kind of how I got started. So it was like the EU first. And then after that was done, I was like, oh my God, there's more series. There's like an endless amount of series I can read. There's movies, like, and then everything sort of snowballed after that.
That is interesting. So yeah, because I think that you and I have talked about this a little bit, because I think there are certain people out there in the costuming community that have kind of carried the water for the EU and some of these outside stories that, of course, Lucasfilm occasionally will, you know, retcon, or they just will kind of ignore, but then pull parts from and all that. And I know that, and it's just interesting hearing that you were almost more of a reader first versus, I mean, were you also watching the movies too, or were you more like, I'm into books and I like what they're building here versus an hour and a half movie, you know? Cause I was the opposite. I was like, EU seems too slow for me, but I'm also like a 12-year-old boy at that point. I don't think I could have been paid to read a book.
Yeah, I think my style, like how I absorb stories, is like I want them to be as detailed and as lingering as possible. Like I want to know every single detail in the character's head. I want you to spend way too much time on every scene. Like the more the better. And like, so movies were like too fast for me. They always felt like, wait, that's it? Like you left out so much. Like who was that? Sure. What did they do? How did that make them feel? So like, I was obsessed with the movies, obviously, but it's like wasn't where the meat was for me. Like I needed the books and I needed the games and I needed the comics. And that's like where I felt like these stories actually got fleshed out. And the movies were just this like, you could paint the picture better with the movies, but then you took that back to the books where like the real content was.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So how did that you've developed this nice, healthy Star Wars obsession. And then from there, how did that turn into, where did the costuming and creator part start to intersect for you?
I mean, that was probably even earlier than my obsession with Star Wars. My first love was and still is writing. I would, before I could even read or write, I would hand pieces of paper and pencils to my mom and say, write this down. And I would just tell her this story that she had to basically dictate for me. So I've just always sort of been a creative, and I liked making stories. I always played dress up. We had something downstairs we called the dress up bin, which was every Halloween costume plus every other costume we had collected over the years. And I would play dress up all the time. And then when Star Wars got introduced, it was just natural. Like I needed to have one of those, like, you know, plastic telescoping lightsaber toys immediately. I had Qui-Gons because I'm the oldest, so I had to be the Jedi Master, and my sister had to be my apprentice, so she got Obi-Wan saber. Yeah, and then I just started building Jedi costumes with just random fabrics that I had laying around. And I think that even when I was like this 10-year-old, or maybe I was even younger, dressing up as a Jedi, like, I think I knew that the minute I had the resources, like, the minute I was older and I had the skills, I was going to build a costume that could, like, pass for being on screen. So I think that was a goal from, like, childhood even.
Was that the first costume that you actually built then? Like, in terms of, like, where did it become as a late bloomer myself to costuming? It's like, I was one of those people, even in college, I'm like, I have to have a great Halloween costume. You know, that was like my thing. And then from there, when I had kind of been introduced to a couple people within the 501st, and I feel like I had always known about it, but I had always assumed I'll never be able to A, afford it, or B, have the skills to be able to do it. So it was getting into a different world, of course. But then when you actually start building these costumes, and like you said, for screen accuracy, like what was that for you? Like, where was that at?
Yeah, so I didn't know about the existence of the 501st or the costuming clubs before I had already decided that I was going to build something screen accurate. So I'd say around like 15, 16 years old when I said, Like, I think I am old enough that I could build something like this. Like, I think I could learn. Yeah. I started researching just, you know, the costume I wanted to build. And because I was super into Mandalorians right then, and I've always liked custom things, I was like, well, I'm going to build a custom Mandalorian. So I started doing all this research, and it led me to, like, you know, I was on DeviantArt and just, like, around the internet. And I've always been a huge fan of forums. And I, like, quickly discovered, like, oh, there are people who are already doing this. Like, there are whole platforms for people who are doing this and resources. Yeah. So I never really got involved with my local group, even though I adore all of them. I was kind of shy and preferred doing my, you know, talking and interacting over the internet. So, like, the forums were, like, a goldmine for me of just resources and, like, friendships that I made there. So, like, I got addicted very quickly to that, like, that community and everything there was. And it took me a few years of basically just reading around, bumming around until I was actually old enough to, like, build things and have the money to, like, purchase the supplies that were nice enough. And so I had probably about like 3 years of failures of just, you know, trying something and it not working and me throwing it out because I had super high standards before I finally, like, made something that I thought was really good.
This is the way, right? Of course. So that from that process, then, are you, you know, how are you learning at this point? Because it's one thing to read a forum and go, okay, this person says just do a stitch here. And I always thought that that was the hardest part because I'm lucky enough to have, like, my mother-in-law help me. You know, she's like, oh, I know how to do this stuff. Like, okay, I'm like,
yeah.
I got to cut out pockets. I got to, like, I don't know how any of this stuff works. So what was, just because I know what you're known for now, where did you really start to get, you know, start utilizing the tools and the fabrics? And, like, are you formally trained in any of this? Or this is all, like, stuff that you've just learned?
Yeah. So when I was little, because I always wanted to get my hands on every creative pursuit, I used to sew, like, stuffed animals or, like, quilts for my American Girl dolls and just kind of anything creative. I had, like, a sock full of rice that was a dragon that I made as a kid. But, like, I hadn't done sewing in a while. And sewing actually wasn't what I got focused on when I first got into Star Wars costuming. I actually learned how to metal work first. So my grandfather was the vice president of the Sheet Metal Workers Union in Minnesota. And he had passed years before, but we still had all of his tools. And his name had some pull in the community around me. So I kind of, you know, my mom asked around for me and I got people who were willing to give me, like, 18 gauge sheet aluminum. And I had his tools and I had his tin snips and his, you know, I went out and got a brand new ball peen hammer. And I sort of, over the course of a year and a half, taught myself how to metalwork. So that was actually where I got started. And I tortured my mom with all of these sewing portions. And it was actually that process that made me go, okay, I have to learn how to sew, because I would come to her with these, like, doomed to fail concepts where it's like,
yeah,
just sew it like this. And then she'd finish and she would have done it. She did it exactly like I asked her to. And then I would realize, like, oh, that doesn't, like, look how I had hoped it would look. And so I wouldn't use it. And I felt so bad because I was
just
like, it's
wasting
not your
time,
sewing.
Right?
Yeah. It's my concepting that's bad. And so I was like, I can't do this anymore. I have to be the one who's wasting her time and sewing. So at the beginning, I was self-taught. And then eventually it did lead me to, I eventually went to school for college for apparel design. So I did eventually get formal training there, but I did learn to sew just self-taught out of necessity to begin
with. Where was that at? Where did you go to get your education?
I graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Stout. So I lived in Minnesota for the first, like, 25 years of my life before moving to Georgia. So
I always just ask because I think it's fascinating, like, where you really start to see, especially in, like, a formal education, where you go, oh, yeah, I think about things differently. And I kind of envy some people who have just kind of done it strictly out of pursuit of happiness, I think, you know, because like, my day job is a creative, like, that's what my day job is, right? And so it's weird that I need a creative outlet for my creative day job, right? And I'm sure that you can empathize with that, because I think in some ways it's like, well, just having, like, an idea of being like, I'm not creative enough, but you do it for a living.
Yeah. And I always try to, like, shy away from the words, like, self-taught versus, like, formally trained, because it's like, think everyone's self-taught and everyone's a bit formally trained. Like,
sure.
So much of what got me to that degree eventually was me self-teaching myself. And frankly, the way college works, a lot of me in college was me teaching myself. And it was right. just the necessity of someone telling you, like, well, you have an assignment, like, you got to do it. So I guess you have to learn.
Right, right, right. So. And there are plenty of people who also have college degrees that are still complete idiots. So let's not make it seem like everyone who passes through those marble walls knows what they're talking about. So, all right. So you have a degree. You've got formal training in this. You know what the hell you're doing. And have you, like, even when you were in college, I mean, was Star Wars and all this, like, you were costuming the whole time, even through your college degree, right? Was that,
oh, yeah.
was that a part
oh, yeah.
of? Okay. So how did that work for you?
Costuming for me started when I was like 15 or 16 and it has never stopped.
I love that. That's like, that's my quote right there. That's my pull quote right there for your piece.
Yeah. I mean, it slowed down. I would say back then when I was in college, I did most of my costuming work during the summers that I was off, and I would draw or write when I was in college because that was like a less needed, less tools and space and time to do those things. So I actually miss drawing. I don't draw as much anymore because I kind of costume year round at this point. I'm like always building, and it used to just be like, you know, June to August was when I was making my costumes.
Yeah. And then are you still like, is costuming your full-time gig, or are you currently like, what is kind of like your work setup? I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, I have a full-time job. So I work in the apparel industry as an apparel designer.
Okay.
So I currently work on like activewear and things like that. So that's totally full-time, totally separate from what I do here. Thankfully, I just really like doing things. Like, yes. I don't have a lot of downtime. Like, when yeah. I'm not working my full-time job, I'm working my side gigs and my hobbies, which are kind of all related. So
yeah. Well, I always ask because I was talking to John Ficker about this. I know it's down in your neck of the woods, and there's just like a part of I recognize people who can take the dive and say, I'm going full time with this thing, because, you know, based on what John sees and like your commission slots go incredibly fast, there are some days where you probably think, like, could I do this? You know what I mean? And then I think there's that, like, that little voice inside of our head that's like, you know, if you turn this into a full-time job, then it doesn't get to be your passion project anymore. Like, how yeah. do you, you know, how do you balance those two things?
I think right now there are two wolves in me. And one of them is okay with the amount that I do on the side and having this full-time job that I also find, you know, pretty fulfilling.
Yeah.
But I think there's always going to be that side, and I'm always going to sort of pursue it that says, like, I think that I have something that not everyone has. I think sure. that I could take this to, like, the next step. So I'm definitely working towards that. The speed is not always, you know, at the same pace. But yeah, I think there are two paths, and I'll be pretty satisfied with either of them. But we'll see.
Sure. Does your day job allow for you to, you know, are you able to kind of partition, like, what, you know, do you ever pull skills or do you ever pull ideas from your day job into your costuming?
Oh, yeah, I absolutely use, I would say I use similar skills. I don't know that I would consider them totally the same.
Yeah.
Costuming is a lot of like building by hand. I'm the one doing the constructing. I'm the one doing the concepting.
Sure.
And what I do at work is a lot of like, I'm talking to people about how to construct something. So,
right,
you know, we work with factories. A lot of the time it's like, you know, we're designing and then we're telling them how to make it, what we want. So
yeah.
it's like there's a pass off point in the process, whereas like of what course. I do here, I'm usually on the very other end of the process.
Yeah. And when I used to work a little bit heavier with apparel, you know, it really does. Yeah. There is a language for understanding like how things are actually made. And so when you see products that come out from companies like Anovos and all of that, and then people go, can you believe the prices of some of this stuff? And I'm sitting here going, have you seen how little some of these, you know, I don't know if how many people yeah. have worked with a textile factory before, mm-hmm. but
how
usually
many people touch one thing to get something produced. It's like, it should be more expensive.
Exactly. So I'm not defending any of the, you know, I'm not defending any of the big costumers, but I'm just saying is that, like, I think in some ways Star Wars costuming is a way smaller community than people oftentimes think, and that there's a reason why when Anovos kind of went away, that there wasn't this just like vacuum of people looking to be licensed makers of this stuff, because you know it. It's like oftentimes for the price of what it takes to get something made in terms of, you know, to get in the door with some of these factories, you're talking thousands of pieces, or else they're not even going to answer your call, because that's the way that they work.
And a lot of just positions too. It's like, you know, I might know how to design something, but it's like, and I might understand a little bit of the business of it, but like, there's so many people who I work with at work. It's like, there's so many parts to this process that like you would also have to know.
Yeah. And take, and
like
takes,
actually.
Right. And takes 100% of your focus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like even having someone who you're like, what, this person does like what you do this? Like, that seems like a 10-minute conversation. And then you're like, oh.
Yeah, there's someone who has to understand the financials, and there's someone who has to market it, and there's someone who has to actually understand how it's made. Someone has to understand the materials. It's, yeah, it would be hard for one person to ever do that. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Well, so let's get a little bit into like costuming for you, especially in Star Wars, because we're going to talk about Gabber Creep, because I have so many questions, because I absolutely love what you've built with that brand. But for you particularly, you are like, I mean, just hearing your story of how long you've been building things. I mean, you are a painter, finisher, designer. I mean, you are kind of like a you got it all. You pride yourself in being like a ground up builder. How much, what is there a part of the process that you love? Is there a part of the process you don't love as much? Is it all awesome? What's your philosophy on costuming?
I don't know. I mean, one thing that I love about costuming is that, like, there was a point where I reached where I was like, I may not know how to do this particular thing yet, but if I decided that I wanted to learn, I know that I could teach myself.
Sure.
So it's like, you're constantly able to add these skills and know, like, if there was a project coming up that, like, you wanted to do, you could teach it to yourself. Like, and that was, I think it was, like, my Ahsoka headtails that I made eventually that made me go, like, oh, so I can just literally learn anything if I want to spend the time and waste all the money.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the build is where I get the most joy. Like, I always have a crash after I get photos of my new costume, because it's like, yeah, this is super cool, but like, now I got nothing to work on.
Yeah.
It's done. Yeah, I don't know if there's really a part of the process that I hate, because like, I like to be busy, and I like when I'm in the zone, and I like building, and I like all of that. There's like certain things that don't get me going as much. Like, I never have really enjoyed working on like prop weapons or like big hard pieces of costumes, because I think that those, like, they just don't, like, I just don't care about weapons and props. It's like the wearable pieces where I really like want to spend the attention. So like that sort of thing. But I don't know. There's not like a particular part that I like more than other parts.
Well, you've got over 10 different costumes, and you've built a lot of characters that have been both out of EU and Legends, and then you've also built costumes of characters that we've seen on screen. Is there a particular character that, like, you're really drawn? Like, you were really like, oh, I just bought, you know, because there's characters, I won't lie. There are characters that I look at and I go, I don't really care about that character at all, but they got some damn cool armor and I probably want to build that. You know, like, I've like Boba Fett. I was never like a Boba Fett fan dude, but I probably want to build that armor just because, like, I like the look of it. I think it's cool. Like, is there any character that you vibe with enough that you were like, I got to build this suit? Like, I'm all about it.
So I am definitely of the school where I have to have like an emotional connection with the subject matter before I would ever, like, when I make a costume, it's a love note to that character or that franchise. So like, even if something looks super cool, if I'm not emotionally connected to that character, like, nothing in me wants to build it. I can just think it looks cool. So, like, for example, with Sabine, I didn't immediately vibe with Sabine when they revealed her. I'd been in Mando costuming for so long that, like, when they first showed her, I was like, ooh, I don't know if she really fits with my, understanding of what Mandalorians look like and how they act. Like, I don't know if I dig this. And I went to a premiere. They actually showed like the first two episodes in theaters, and I went in my custom Mando and I watched it and sat on that for like a week. And I was like, oh, they literally just gave us a main character of a TV show who is an artist female Mandalorian. And she's going to like inform the future of Star Wars and this show. Like, I have to build that. Like, she's absolutely for me. So that's like an example of something where like when I first saw it, I wasn't super into it. And then I still had that like light bulb moment where I clicked with them. And then that's when I needed it.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially for someone like Sabine, where like Rebels is, the style was almost like a combination of, it was like more simple than Clone Wars was getting at the time. And like, I love when people are like, oh, Rebels is a show for kids. I'm like, well, in the first like two episodes, they talk about genocide. Like, I'm like, it's not that. If you're watching it strictly on being like, yeah, sure, it's not as like violent as Clone Wars ended up being.
It was like maybe the fifth episode in, and they have that scene where they show you that like Luminara is like basically turned into a mummy in her prison. And I was like, oh, we're going here with this. Like, yeah, I am like on board.
Yeah, they used her body as like a trap. I'm bait. Like, what is, right? I'm like, what's going on at this? So
I was like, I'm 100% down for wherever the show is going.
Yeah, it's a kid's show. Use their body as bait. I feel like having the Sabine just had such a look to her, and I envy anyone who's ever built any iteration of her because she had a different look. I mean, I'm with you. The first time I'm like, oh, we have like graffiti artists and Star Wars. I'm like, what is that? You know, same reaction that you had. And then it's really cool to hear you be like, but damn, like, let me look past my initial reaction for a second and think she's a vibe.
And then the growth that we saw her go through was just like so rewarding. And she basically became like, you know, the other main character of this show.
Right.
It was just very rewarding. And then even as like an artist who likes to build these sort of things, the fact that my kit could change as hers did on the show, like,
yeah, of course,
that was awesome. That was like years of costuming for me was just redoing Sabine. I like kind of didn't know what to do at the end of it.
Yeah. Did you see Ben Huckabee, his like modernized version of Sabine from, he goes by Dirty Rogue Designs online.
Oh yes, yes. Oh my god, that's so, it was so good. Yeah, that he did a Hartel Studios envisioned Sabine would be in the live action.
Well, because I see that, and I think that's probably what we would have assumed that a new Mandalorian on screen would have, like, that would have kind of been like what they would have put off. But we got this racing checker flag on one of the pauldrons. We got this bright yellow spray paint, and it was kind of like, it was really jarring. But I agree. It's like, I love...
But you know what I love about that is, like, you start to understand her and the fact that she was basically, she was like a baby when the Mandalorians lost their ability to practice being Mandalorians anymore. And she was basically sent away to, like, Imperial boarding school. So, like, in a way, she had her own interpretation of how she could still connect with her culture as someone who was taken out of it. And I just think that's, like, super powerful and has a lot of like real world parallels. And then you even think about like where her kit ended up at the very end of the show when she's like a little bit older and she's like 26, like, and her kit just looks super Mandalorian there. Like there's not a lot of the kid left.
Right. Right.
So,
but still had her personality in it, which I love, you know?
Yeah. And I love where they ended up. I love that that's where my armor gets to like remain.
Yeah. And then exciting, of course, to see where they pick it all back up. Let's get into a little bit of the details. I've got to know. So your husband, I won't reveal his name in case he doesn't want to be outed, but he goes by the real Lucas McCoy, right? This is his alter ego. And that's for you to figure out if you want to go investigate. But the two of you are costumers together. What the heck is your setup like? It's got to be amazing. Like, what does the costume studio look like over at that household?
Well, we only moved in here maybe 2 years ago, and I'm a very bad decorator. So it's like taken us a minute to set up. But like, I look around, and this is like, if 12-year-old me could see this,
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
I have like everything I could have ever wanted.
I made it! I made it!
So many props, and I just live around Star Wars, and that's what my house looks like, and yeah, it's pretty great.
Or is there a specific like studio that you guys have in your spot, or is it just if you walk into one room, there's a half finished project?
Yeah, it kind of is spread out everywhere. We have a workshop in the basement that's kind of like, you know, cement floors. So that's where all like, you know, the dirty crafting is.
Sure.
You know, you'll spray paint outside, but you can like Dremel and cut stuff and work in the downstairs area. And then I have my room up here that is like my sewing studio. And that's like specifically for me. And to keep all of my stuff. But yeah, and then projects just sort of migrate out into all of the living areas, but definitely better than it used to be now that we have a little bit more space.
Yeah, I'm jealous. So specific stuff, I got to know, as I said, someone who is like, I'm always poking around. And every time I go to the craft store and I see a sewing machine and I think, is today going to be the day where I'm going to buy yet another expensive piece of equipment and barely ever touch it? So tell me specifically about the machines that you use to get the results that you get, because I've got to know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a fancy setup and I kind of never have. Like, when I was doing metalworking, I would dish and planish on an old car jack because it had a little bowl shape on it, and I would planish on a bowling ball because it was smooth and round. And I do have a real sewing machine, but it's literally a metal Kenmore that I got from the thrift store for probably $25. But, you know, it's super solid. It runs great. I have, like, a Simplicity serger that I bought secondhand off of someone, and that's kind of it. I have my iron. That's pressing is almost more important than sewing. And I feel like a lot of people miss that. But like, yeah, it's kind of all I utilize. I will someday own an industrial sewing machine. That's just like something I've decided. But yeah, I don't have the need for it yet. And I think you had John Ficker on your show. He's
yeah.
a close friend. And boy, he has everything. So if I really need to like set a zipper into like a leather trim, like
yeah,
I go to his
he's
place.
Your guy.
Yeah,
well, that's I'm laughing. I say oh no when you're like, I don't have anything simple, because then that means that clearly it's just me, it's not actually any of the machines that I don't have.
Because I've been doing this for so long, I just think people can do more in a scrappy way than I think that they realize.
Sure. I love that mentality. Absolutely. Well, Emma, speak to me, you know, talk to me like I'm 35. Tell me the difference between, you said a serger.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
So just a regular lock stitch machine, which is the, like your basic sewing machine.
Yeah.
Is not even like, and a serger, like that's not even the end of how many machines do all these different things, but like a lock stitch machine, which is like your home sewing machine, that's for sewing, you know, non-stretch wovens, anything like that. Sergers are generally used for sewing stretch garments and for like edge finishing. So like if you ever look at a t-shirt and it's got all this thread around the seam,
yeah.
that was done on a serger. And it's basically to like cover and finish that edge so it doesn't fray. So I don't do a lot of stretch garments. I'm not really a superhero customer. So like
yeah.
usually I'm using the lock stitch machine, and I'm also lining most of my things, so I don't use the serger super often, but that is what it's for.
Okay, so I watched a video. Does it cut too? Does it also cut a serger?
Yeah, sergers have a knife on them. So like as you run it through the machine, it's cutting off the edge of the fabric and sewing right after that.
Oh, dang. Okay. All right. So sergers, what's a going rate for a decent serger? How much is that?
You know, I'm probably not the person to ask because I got everything secondhand.
A couple of something, couple $100 at this point. Maybe.
You could probably get a basic serger, I would estimate, for even under $200. And,
oh, okay.
But if you want like high end, $400.
Okay. Okay. That's fine. All right. Now at least I have a ballpark. Do you do any leather sewing yourself? Do you sew any leather?
Yeah.
Okay.
I do quite a bit, actually. When I made my Revan costume was kind of my trial by fire, because she has that whole leather vest that I decided, oh yeah, I can sew 40 pieces of leather together on a lock stitch machine. I've kind of made it work just by using the right needles. Like you use leather needles, so they're stronger, and I think my sewing machine has a bit more weight to it because it's, you know, an old metal Kenmore than like the lighter plastic ones. So it like holds itself to the table a little bit better.
Right.
But you just kind of learn it. You learn your machine's quirks and like what it's capable of and how you can force something through it. It's not necessarily for sewing leather, and I couldn't do anything that's like super thick or complex, but I've managed with what I have. But yeah, definitely done some leather work, and I've made like gear belt holsters, but a lot of that is gluing and hammering instead.
Oh, okay. Well, so yeah, so I'm going on the Galactic Star Cruiser, a, you know, Disney experience. And of course I'm like, I've bought all this stuff and I want to do some custom belts. And I'm like, oh, I'm making belts, belt buckles out of like acrylic, cause that's kind of like my specialty is like laser engraving and cutting. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing stuff with like screw posts, right? So that they kind of have like a, just kind of a flat look. You can buy a couple different heads on them. It just kind of looks cool. And then I know that if I showed this to a leather worker, they might be like, what are you doing, man? But there's also a part of me where it's like, I physically don't have the capabilities to do leather stitching on my own, at least to what my knowledge is.
Yeah, I mean, I would consider myself a novice when it comes to leather work. I've managed to make cool things. I don't know if I've necessarily done it in the right way. And I think there's like different ways to do leather. Like, my Sabine belts and holsters, which are, you know, semi-complex, I don't think there's a single stitch on them. I think all of that was either contact cement, which is a legitimate way of putting leather together, or they were, like, hammered metal rivets, and that's another legitimate way of putting leather together. Like, on the show, you can see that she has rivets on her belt, so I put rivets where there were rivets.
Sure, sure. And that's... So you're using barge cement, or is there any, like, adhesive particularly that you're like fond of that works for you?
Just contact cement. I don't have a brand that I use, but that's like, I think something that Ficker probably taught me years ago, just like, you know, scoring the leather and you paint it on and you let it sit for 15 minutes, you know, on both sides and put it together, and that baby's not budging.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's interesting because when I was getting into building costumes for the first time, there's always that like, you know, okay, we got to make snaps, then we have to do the inside of the costume, we have to do all this stuff. And then you're using largely, you know, I only have costumes besides my Mandalorian, I only have costumes from the original trilogy. So everything's ABS, right? Mm-hmm. And when people started getting into flexible stuff and then, oh, you have to use E6000, I'm like, what? Like, I use plastic bonder. Like, what is all this stuff?
I feel like everyone has their go-to adhesive, and it's such a personal thing. There's not like a right or a wrong necessarily. Like, JB Weld is always going to be like my one true love when it comes to adhesives, but it's also not for every job.
Yeah, sure, sure. No, that's I completely agree. I think, you know, once something works really, you know, I've almost like sworn off E6000, even though I know other people swear by it. Because
that's my husband's go-to adhesive is E6000.
If you can figure out how to use it, and it's like some people do, and they're like, dude, I'm sold. I'll, you know, I got my, it's holding my tires on my car. It's great. Is there, Emma, is there for someone who's getting into, you know, a big part of, and I think it's kind of sounds like this was your experience with your mom back in the day when you're getting into silhouettes, right? Like I'm always interested to know how something's going to fit or it's going to look on me without fully committing to start, you know, cause like, I just don't understand how to fit stuff to yourself. And I'm trying to build kind of like an overcoat looking thing. And I know there's templates and I know there's, you know, patterns out there and stuff. And I always feel like I don't know how to put that stuff. Like, how the hell do I do this?
Yeah. I mean, there's like different tricks and I use all of them. Like, I was taught metric pattern drafting in school and I've done some things that way where it's literally like you go step by step in a book that tells you how to like draft a basic pant pattern. Like, take this measurement and take this measurement, do this to it, draw this line at this angle. And you just follow the instructions to the end and you make a mock-up and you change what you need to. A lot of the times also what I'm doing, I'm literally going to like a thrift store and buying something that's similar and tearing it apart and using that as a pattern. Like if I have a jacket that already sort of fits how I want it to and I'm willing to cut it up. I'll literally do that and lay it down on a table and make a pattern from it. And like, honestly, we do that in the industry. Like, that's professionally how it's done sometimes is if you have something that, you know, is already close, you're just basically using it for the pattern. At this point, I've been doing it long enough that I have, you know, patterns that I go back to time and again. You know, I have a jacket that's close, I'll cut a mock-up. I'm a big fan of mock-ups. I don't think anyone should be sewing something the first go.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Is there, so you reverse engineer stuff that you like. I mean, that's, mm-hmm. you know, that's really, I agree. I think that's in a really interesting way to go about it, especially when it comes down to stuff and for everyone's body type, right? It's like, you find a jacket that fits you well, you're like, this is my thing. That makes a lot of sense. Is there,
yeah.
when you get into patterns and you start doing that stuff, how much of that, and especially as a commissioner yourself, do you, as you're making these jackets, right, for Gabbercrete, is there a built-in, like, this might, you know, you get measurements and you just have to trust that your customer, like, took the measurements right? Is there, that freaks me out. Like, how do you deal with that?
No, it's terrifying. The idea of making something for someone and it not fitting them, like, horrifying. Because you're like, oh my God, not only does this not work for them, I also feel like I've insulted them because they gave me these measurements and it doesn't fit them. Now they'll think they're weird. Like, and thankfully I've been very lucky. Like, I think I've only had one person have to send something back, and it was because I'd made the sleeves too long for how tall they were. And it was a very easy fix, and they were super kind about it, and it was like a good experience. But yeah, especially, and it's kind of different between costuming and Gabbercrete, because for Gabbercrete, I have these patterns that I've kind of pre-made and prepped, and that they're ready to go. Like, when I'm costuming, I'm starting everything from scratch and I'm drafting from scratch. When I was starting Gabbercrete, it was, I made basically a test size. I mm-hmm. made a medium of, you know, a guy's jacket and a medium of a gal's jacket, and I fit it and made it, you know, fit how I wanted it to. And then I actually sent it off to a professional pattern grader and grading is what they call, like, sizing things up and sizing things just down in the industry, and mm-hmm. I've done that before, but it's not something that I'm confident in, so, like, I definitely worked with someone to grade it for me, so the trust that I have for those patterns is that I trust the professional to have graded it properly, so that when someone gives me their measurements, I know that this fits like a large, and it should fit how they expect a large to fit, and so far it's been successful. So
dang, that's really interesting. Okay, so yeah, that makes sense. And I'm sure that it's difficult, because it's not, you know, you could say, oh, if you're buying something like this, which people are expecting enough customization on it to be like, yeah, this sounds you know, this looks awesome, I want to look like this guy, right? And you kind of also forget that, you know, it's like, every, you know, biceps are different, you know, chest, like your bust is different. You're, you know, some people are weightlifters, some have heavy shoulders. It's like all this stuff. I have such respect for people who do commissions, because it's like I've seen that you make pieces for all different body types, and everyone looks amazing in these jackets. And I think that's awesome. You know, when you get those measurements, are people up front with you? Hey, I've got pretty big arms, or is that, you don't really need to know anything because you can see it all in the measurements, right?
Yeah, I think people tend to know themselves, or they know the parts of themselves that, like, always give them trouble when they're trying on clothes. So
yeah, yeah.
They kind of know how to speak to themselves, but, like, I also just, you kind of learn the measurements and you learn what to look for. And generally my patterns are like, I don't modify them person to person, but if I notice that someone is, like, especially, like, hourglass shaped or something, like, I might go in and, like, tweak it a little bit. Or if, like, someone calls out, like, hey, I feel like I have really short arms, I'll, you know, say, okay, like, what's your sleeve measurement? I can shorten it for you for sure.
Sure.
That sort of thing. But yeah, I honestly haven't run into it too much. It's something that keeps me up at night. The idea that I'm not, like, you know, I can't custom fit a person who I've never seen before. But yeah, it's something that I hope to, like, improve. Like, I have things in mind that I want to, like, tweak on the patterns. Like, I might, you know, get a V2 going here at some point, like a slightly improved, like, size scale or something, but
I love that. Let's get a little bit into concept and you just kind of overall aesthetic, because I know that's something I really admired in your stuff. The fandom is kind of in a weird spot, especially among creators. And it's something that I always wrestle with in my little side business of Honda Supply. I make these little ID cards. Mm-hmm. And I'm constantly torn myself between being like, am I emulating the stuff that emulated Star Wars, or am I still invoking the, you know, late 70s post-disco vibe meshed with the World War II vibe of 1977's Star Wars, A New Hope, right? Aesthetically, you have people that come to you, and I'm sure they have, oh, my character that I'm building this jacket for. You know, they're coming with you probably with some story, and you're also a person who can lean into stories too. So how does that process work for someone who wants a custom jacket, whether it's with a character built in for themselves or they just give you color palette? Like, tell me a little bit about that process.
Yeah, I mean, I tell people I can work with as much or as little direction as you give me.
Awesome.
So I've had people who literally go, these are the colors I want, go crazy. Or most of the time people are saying, I want box pleats. Anything else is whatever
Not
you want.
Star Wars.
Okay. Yeah, that's what they're coming. That's what they're coming for me for, is the box pleats. But yeah, and then there's some people I've worked off of sketches. Like, someone goes, this is my character, can you make this jacket? And I say, yes, I can recreate that jacket exactly. So people will give me, like, I like this character, and I like Cassian's jacket, and I like Han's this. Like, can you do something to put these together? So it's kind of across the board, like, what people want. I can also do one that was really fun for me. Is a close friend of mine is not necessarily like a Star Wars fan, but she's a huge Sailor Moon fan. So she said, I want you to make a jacket based on Sailor Uranus, because she's like the warrior Sailor Scout. She seems like the most Mandalorian of the group, or the most Star Wars. So I took that and I kind of, just used it for inspiration. I think you can take anything and make it into a Star Wars feel. The danger zone is when you are trying to like do crossover things or have too much. Like, if you're looking at one of these jackets and you don't know what it was based on, I don't really want you to be able to tell where the inspiration came from. Like, the creator will know that it was a Sailor Moon jacket, but you looking at it will just go, that's a cool Star Wars jacket.
Sure. Yeah. And there's always that balance between understanding when something comes across as Star Wars, because people don't really, I think oftentimes when we go back and we really start to dissect what the costuming department, John Mollo and all those guys, were doing in 1977, was also a little bit out of necessity, because the movie was shot on such budget. It was like, you know, people were like, why do all the guns look like World War II? And it's like, because they went to the BAPTI prop house and said, take the scopes and flip them backwards, and now it's a space gun. Okay. And, you know, just seeing how almost in many ways, especially for the jackets, you know, it's like you look at Greedo's jacket, right? Which is, you know, there. And for people who are wondering why you're always poking fun at box pleats, because they're amazing and they're incredibly difficult to reproduce, right? Because box pleats are that those rectangular, literally look like little boxes that go down
like
your arm.
Ribbing that goes down the sleeve on like snow speeder jackets and Luke's like yellow ceremony jacket at the end of four. They show up a lot.
Yeah. And famously Greedo's, it's teal with orange down the side, right? Is that what it is?
It's teal. Is there some
yellow?
Like cream? I think you're right. It's orange something.
You might be right
somewhere.
Too. But they're most certainly box pleats. Absolutely. I mean, it is like obnoxious. But I think really what happened, and you look at some of the like the snowspeeder jackets, and you look at where they found. I mean, some of them were just like literally snowmobile jackets with patches put over them. I mean, it was like hilarious what they put together and said, this is space wear now. You know. And going back from what you're kind of dissecting those things and figuring out like what's Star Wars and what just feels like you want it to look like cool, spacey vibe.
I honestly think that, and maybe this is not like a good thing, but I almost think it's a good thing. I am really like only into Star Wars. Like a lot of people I feel like are into different science, like science fiction IPs or fantasy, or like they're fans of multiple things. You know, I've been softer fans of different things. Like I like Mass Effect a lot and I like Legend of Zelda and yada yada, but like nothing has ever been like Star Wars to me. So I feel like I don't have a lot of extra stuff bouncing around in my head to confuse the matter. I only look at Star Wars all day, every day. And so that's all I have to put on the paper.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Is there, so when you're making these jackets and, you know, you've got, of course, like the box pleats are the thing that identifies a lot with Star Wars, but then you look at other stuff like Han's vest, and then you look at other things like, you know, even more recently, Cassian's vest, and then you have the Rebellion Marines, if you want to call them that, in Rogue One. They've got these almost like Vietnam, you know, M65 flak jackets, the navy blue ones with the yellow spray paint. I mean, they're just they're sick. They're so good. How do you, when you see new stuff, like, where does your mind go? Do you think how to start breaking that down? Do you think, like, you know, the newer, like, it, like, and when you make Gabbercrete stuff, some of it is so fresh. And do you kind of almost wish at times you could be like, all right, now let me go out and drag this in the mud so it actually feels like you were part of the rebellion before I send it all nice and clean to you?
Yeah, I leave the weathering to the client.
Customer.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just start to, when you start looking for the details, you start to recognize them and like these things that like reoccur. And I think you can't really discount the fact that Star Wars was made in like the late 70s, early 80s. And like the silhouettes of the original trilogy, the prequels are a totally different aesthetic, but like they are a product of their time. And so like a lot of it is very 70s, like the cuts are 70s, the crops are 70s. Like I think I had someone get their jacket from me and they kind of panicked because they thought it didn't fit them. They're like, oh, it's short. It's like it's too short in the waist. And it's like, no, that's where people wore their belts in the 70s. So like, right. You know, these jackets, like there's this reoccurring thing where they're like, they're boxy, they're cropped.
Yeah.
Like more cropped than we're used to for like a men's jacket these days. So it's like, even just little elements like that are things that I love so much. Just like where a jacket ends on your torso.
Right.
It's like something that immediately takes something from like modern times to a Star Wars jacket. And like the closures, the fact that you don't want to see any closures most of the time.
Right.
I know like zippers and things are starting to sneak on screen more and more, which I don't love, but
yeah,
I can live with it. But yeah, just like things that you start to notice, like Star Wars, you don't see closures. They have, you know, in the books, it's called gription. Like,
yeah, right.
That it's gonna close these things. Yeah, it's just fun to start recognizing them and like, you know, oversized pocketing and the quilting and yeah.
Well, I think we really saw it nailed in Rogue One.
Yeah, they really understood.
Yeah, like mainly in the blue leader, Merrick, right? Merrick. In
my
that
friends are all building blue squadron pilots right now. And it's great.
Yeah, respectfully so. But you know, it's like Ben Daniels, 1970s, they made him look with his sideburns and his hair was kind of all, you know, I mean, it just looked something. And then what was cool is that, you know, and they had that, they spliced that old footage into it, like on the run in the battle for Scarif.
Yeah, I think the biggest cheer from my group of friends in that movie was Gold Leader. Just how excited they were to see just Gold Leader.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And having that, do you watch the movies? Like, do you have to watch the movies multiple times because the first watch you're just soaking all these details in and missing other parts?
Yeah, when I first watch a movie, I'm not usually dissecting it for costume stuff necessarily. Like I'm there for the story and the experience. And like, I'll go back later for a close watch if there's like something I need to go back for. And I tend to buy all the art books and the concept books are where I start to like really trigger on like, ooh, I need to go back and look at this guys.
Sure. And I think Rogue One just, and even actually, I give a lot of respect to Solo too, because Solo and them were done by the same production team. That's Glenn Dillon, and he's with the team over in the UK, and they were responsible for, you know, the Shore Troopers, the Death Troopers, the Range Troopers, and all of them had just, you know, Mimban when they, you know, get dropped. You know, you're an EU fan, right? Like, they get dropped on Mimban, and all of a sudden everything's covered in mud, and everyone just looks like crap. And I'm like, this is fun. Like, they had, you know, the mud troopers had the poncho, and I'm like, I bought a poncho off you, because I'm like, I was vibing with that, you know. I thought that was awesome.
So they good job of introducing new things, but making it feel like just exactly how it was.
Yeah, and do you feel like when you see that stuff, do you, you know, what inspires you in terms of when you see something new? And I know that you said that, like, when you build something personally, you have to have an emotional connection to mm-hmm. it. I totally get that. I'm with you on that for a personal build of mine. And then there's other times where I just recognize that the designers just did, that's amazing. That looks awesome. But I wouldn't build it myself, you know? So, like, what, when you watch new Star Wars, like, what stuff that jump, what, you know, what jumps off the screen to you as a, as a costumer, as a, you know, designer yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's probably not any secret to people who know me that I'm not, like, the biggest Disney Star Wars fan. Like, I still got hurt feelings over the whole thing because the EU is my baby.
Sure.
But, like, I can usually tell, like, pretty right away if I'm vibing with something new on the screen and I'm like, yes, they got it. I feel like they did their research. They understand where this is coming from. And someone who I'm like, ooh, I don't think that's good. Like, that does not feel right. But, sure. like, I definitely, like, I leave space for the stuff that I feel, like, is good and can be added and is, like, additional. Like, I think that Rogue One was a great story. Like, obviously, it does, like, step over old story content that, like, tells a similar thing. But it was so in the spirit of it. It's like, yeah, this logically fits in with the old stuff. It looks like it's supposed to. It feels good. I think it's definitely just, like, you see it and you... you like it or you don't, and it's an emotional connection. I think a really good example of this was the Battlefront series, actually, that has come out recently. The Battlefront games had really, really good designs, and when Battlefront 2 came out, I think they knew right away, like, that Sulliston trooper uniform with the quilted jacket was, like, the winner from the first game, like, so much the winner that they put it on one of the main characters in the second game. And that was just, like, all the solidifying I needed, where it's like, that is a great design. Shriv is an amazing character. Everything about this is perfect. So we made the Shriv costume, because it's like, he's totally new, but, like, I love him like I've known him for, you know, 15 years. So there's, like, still room for that connection with, like, the new stuff that's coming out. And sometimes they get it right, and sometimes I feel like they get it wrong, but they still get a lot right.
Yeah. Well, and I was talking to your husband about this. You know, you have a character like Shriv, who, if you're wondering, like, who the heck is Shriv? Shriv is the species. He's a Duros. And Duros is that, you know, kind of wonky blue skinned, big yellow, red eyes, depending on what light it is. And, you know, they have that almost, I don't know, would you call them, like, that almost like iconic alien kind of look, like giant.
Yeah, they look like a gray, but they're blue with red eyes.
Yeah. And then famously, of course, over the last, by the time this comes out, you will have watched, the season finale would have already come out, but, you know, we're still reeling from seeing Cad Bane brought back to live screen. And what I was talking about with your husband is, you know, for people who have built these costumes, there's that immediate reaction when they see one of them on screen, because there are tons of characters in the EU from video games, from other storytelling that we haven't seen on screen yet. And there are people who have either built these costumes or they brought them to life. And so when you see a costume done for screen and you kind of have a reaction to it of like, oh, that's different than how I would have done it. Or I'm sitting here and I'm looking at it going, that doesn't look like the one that I made. you know, what is that? And I think you and I actually had a conversation about it a couple episodes back. You know, what is, how do you balance that? How do you keep your motivation to say, I'm going to keep doing me? And then how do you balance between also showing other creatives respect too? Because what your husband and I were talking about was, of course, that the Duros, we haven't really seen them talk yet. And mm-hmm. Cad Bane obviously has speaking roles. And, you know, then as soon as your prosthetic mask has to start talking, you got to put teeth in it.
Yeah, the roles are different.
Yeah. So it's like, I know that there were people who were like, oh, CGI the mouth. And I'm like, but the spirit of Star Wars has always been in trying to build the damn thing, you know?
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that?
Star Wars is like, it has a history of pushing the envelope. The technology doesn't exist. Star Wars makes it. And they've been doing that since the very first movie they ever made.
Right.
So, like, if they want to start playing with, like, CGI deepfake technology, if they want to start pulling in, like, this combination of, like, you know, realistic prosthetics and, like, slightly tweaking how characters have to appear in order to put them on a human face, like, I'm all about that sort of stuff. Like, I think when you get into this super picky territory of like nitpicking that sort of thing, that just feels like a waste of time to me personally.
sure.
Like, I'll be very critical of the story every day, but I can let a lot go in like a visuals department if it's like they're pushing something and the story's good and it's like, it doesn't take very much for me to start getting like lost in the story and the visuals that they're giving me if I'm like loving what they're doing in the plot, in the dialogue. I think it's great that they're doing these things. And I think, you know, people have been passing these specifically for like Cad Bane, let's say they've been passing around these memes where it's like, you know, we saw him on the Clone Wars. Everyone on the Clone Wars looks weird. Like none of them look like, like you would have to destroy this actor's face to make it look like how they look in the Clone Wars. Like the Clone Wars was stylized. So this is an unstylized Cad Bane. Like,
right.
This is what we're first seeing. I thought he looked great. I have no complaints.
Yeah. Well, I'm just, and I just because I've had this conversation so much, and I know that you and your husband had built Duros and mm-hmm. like a, you know, a functional one at that, because I think part of what everyone cracks up about is like, you know, the cantina scene where we saw a lot of these creatures for the first time, right? Like half of them weren't even like real costumes. They were like literally like busts, you know, like there was someone in the background with a stick, like, you know, moving it up and down. So it looked like it was laughing. And then you had other costumes where they put the actor in it and the actor was like, I can't see anything. They said, don't worry about it. Just flail your arms around. And then people are mad that, you know, they saw a new one with a person in it that actually has to emote and be a part of the story, you know? So I'm curious. I've been having a lot of really great and productive conversations with people who build stuff, because I'm very interested in talking to other people who have either had to reach these conclusions on their own without a multi-million dollar budget to be able to figure it out. And there's always that tie-in between where fans and, you know, Brian Matias himself took a lot of inspiration from custom Mandalorians like yourself. Mm-hmm. And I love that we're at this realm now where the people who are on the jobs are taking inspiration from fans too, because people like yourself, you've carried the water for this fandom when Star Wars wasn't cool. The EU was very confusing for a lot of people. It was had a lot of weird themes in it that I think some people really, you know, got stoked on, and it still has a very dedicated community to when they see when these stories get adapted. So, you know, I love talking to people like yourself about this because I think the conversation is fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's amazing the problems that costumers have managed to solve just in the vacuum of when we weren't making films like this. Like, they didn't build a clone trooper costume for the movies. Like, they were all CGI. But people, costumers, figured out how to put a man in a clone trooper costume. You know? We figure out, personally, I don't make a lot, like, I don't know if anyone's drawn this, like, connection, but, like, I don't make a lot of costumes that are, like, on the screen. A lot of what I do is, like, they're video game characters or cartoon characters. So there's this level of interpretation already. And like, I actually love that area where it's like,
sure,
one person's problem solve for something is completely different than another person's, and how they might interpret where a seam should go when it doesn't exist in a cartoon, but would absolutely need to exist in real life for a person to get into a garment. So
right.
I think a lot of it is just that too. Like, costumers solved, you know, the Duros mask problem, but still most of the photos you're getting of these are still photos. Like, your mouth doesn't have to move. You get a snapshot of your Duros costume and it looks great, but like, then you have to put a guy in it and he has to deliver lines and, you know, go up against Boba Fett, and it's like, it's different, but like, we've solved some of it, but like, now they're going to solve other things, and I think that's cool.
Because I see a lot of course, when that came up with, you know, people were, you know, and the part that like drives me nuts about the fandom is then Star Wars or something will post something from this official account, right? And then people will comment and like tag another costumer and be like, you should have gone with this guy instead. And I'm like, don't put that costumer in a weird position to be like, no, you guys are fine, please don't tag me. Like,
also, we're not actors. Like,
right? Like, we do our own thing.
Some of them might be, but like, no, it's a totally different craft.
And it just cracked me up because someone had tagged another person who made, you know, Cad Bane, and it's an amazing sculpt, but they sculpted like the toothpick tooth into it, like the Snarl, you know, the Raphael from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and they put like a toothpick in him. Like, that's an amazing sculpt. If you walked around a convention, you're a legend. That looks awesome. But like, the dude's got to talk now. So like, you need a new mold now, you know? So I'm asking people that because I'm having this conversation, and I'm with you on that. I think, especially for taking inspiration from shows like the Clone Wars and for shows like Rebels, where like everybody in Rebels looked kind of noodly.
Yeah. Gumby.
You know? Yeah, exactly. So like, you know, you didn't see the same level, of course, like now that we had the final season of Clone Wars, where everything in Bad Batch, where it's like, you know, everybody, their proportions are still off, but at least you can see that they're getting closer and closer to trying to figure out the anatomy, right? In making those interpretations for you, how do you feel? Is it like a, you know, I'm looking at the screen, you're looking at the screen, this is how I chose to do it. Other than that, make your own then.
I would say I'm not picky on a lot of that stuff, where it's like you're interpreting a screen or I guess I think of it as Clone Wars was a style, Rebels was a style. When we see it on live action, it's going to be another style, and they're all going to be valid, and like, your head can sort through that. You can understand that it's like, it's art, not everything is going to look the same in every piece of art.
Of course, that makes a lot of sense. What, Emma, for you, what's the hardest part about running like your Star Wars side business and making, still finding time to create for yourself? This is something I'm just asking for myself now, because like, I get to make incredible things for people as customers. And then there's times where I'm like, I want to shut my shop down for 4 weeks so that I can just make stuff for myself. And I know that your commissions open up. I mean, you have to announce the date of when they're opening. You have to announce a time of when they're opening, because they go that fast.
Yeah.
How do you do, like, is that the toughest part? Like, what is the toughest part about running a business? Like, for you?
I don't know. Like, it's different things on different days. I feel very lucky that I feel like I have absolutely found my calling in this community. Like, I've done commissions before for other things where, like, the love just wasn't there. Like, it was pulling teeth to force myself to work on it. And, like, I just didn't love it. And it's like, I've been doing this for two and a half years now. And, like, I still love it. Like, there's a level of creativity that I get to have with these where it's like, it's new every time. I get so much joy out of like creating these beautiful garments, and the fact that like, it's sort of, because I get to put so much of myself and my own personal aesthetic in these a lot of the times, it sort of just feels like I'm being given the permission and the resources to continue to make what I want to make, but just like with like these partners that are my clients who eventually get to go and wear the stuff. Because it's like,
right,
I can make 14 jackets for myself, but I don't have the time to wear 14 jackets. But now it's like, I get to go and like give these pieces that I love new legs. So it's, I feel very fortunate that like, it doesn't feel like pulling teeth to work on commissions. And like, sure, I do sometimes feel sad that like my own costumes have like definitely taken the back seat. Like, I have not found the balance yet for like working on my own stuff versus working on commissions, because I kind of feel like I have not worked on my own stuff ever since starting this. I just thankfully love this. I am trying to find the time though. Like, now that Celebration is approaching, I've like built in a little bit of time to like work on my own things. And I try to like between commissions, like work on little projects for myself just to like keep myself sane. But yeah, I think that a lot of that's going to come with like taking the next step with Gabbercrete. Right now it's like I make everything by hand, I design by hand, I sew by hand. Eventually I would like to reach the point where I'm like outsourcing a little bit of what I'm doing, but it will look different then, and it will be different products than what I'm doing right now. And maybe that's just like a little bit of a preview of what I'm working on in the background. Sure. But like, I think that's what I have to do eventually, is like, I either need to like shrink it where I take less commissions, or I need to grow it where I can serve more people, but I still have more time.
That's an awesome point. Now I'm inquiring, Emma. Because I feel the same way. Like when I have my ID cards and I'm making this stuff and it's like, oh, cool. Like I have my base models, right? Because people want to pick a logo. They want to pick, you know, okay, you know, first order, red, black.
Got a great system going at this point.
Yeah. But then of course it's like, I post pictures of all the like Uber custom stuff I do, and people will send me a message, which I'm thankful for everyone who's ever inquired about my work.
Oh yeah.
Right? I'm sure you feel the same way. You're like, I'm honored that you would even consider talking to me and giving me your money. That's crazy to me still. But there's also a part of it where you know, you do look at it and you think, what could I make easier? And when you're in the level that you and I are in, where it comes to the only reason people are reaching out to us is because they want something customized to them.
Mm-hmm.
I have thought that there would be a huge market for Star Wars inspired stuff that isn't just slathered with freaking logos. You know, it's like I go to Galaxy's Edge and I see, like, I think some of the best stuff they've done is like the ponchos and the subtle Han stuff. And it's like, you know, they have this really great smuggler shirt for, you know, 40, 50 bucks. And it's got the cross chest, the proper cross chest with no enclosures, but it doesn't have freaking rebellion down the side, like, you know, says, you know, fight TIE fighters or whatever they have. Some of the stuff, like, it has great cuts, but it's just like slathered with.
Yeah, you're still dressed as an Earth person,
a tourist.
Yeah, yeah, that's not fun.
Yeah, but like, you know, sure. And you have these cuts, you know, kind of like a generic cut. Is there a future of saying, you know, I'm going to offer this in tan with some interesting cuts on it that make it Star Wars-ish without all these extra logos on it, and then let people take it secondary and fabric paint it if they want, weather it? You know, I mean, is there a, like, you do this, is there a market for that? Do you think people would be into that?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And I think ultimately that's like a big goal that I have for Gabbercrete, is to like get to the point where I can have like, you know, it's reached the point where, and this is so amazing and also humbling, like I have more interest and demand than I know what to do with. And I feel terrible turning people away. You know, I have, you know, I open these runs and I get so much interest and I get to serve like, you know, just a small percentage of people who are looking for this like solution. Like,
yeah.
And so the obvious, where your head obviously goes, is like, how do I serve more people? Like, there are people disappointed at the end of every run that I open because I don't have time for all of them. And like, how do I give them something so that they have like something to run with while I work through like the more complex custom stuff? So that's definitely a goal. And like, it's fun because I feel like I got into this section of Star Wars costuming, I think, right at the right time. Like, I became really interested in this whole, like, you know, what What could I wear so that I look like I fit in to Star Wars on the screen? I would fit in on the street. It's not necessarily a bounty hunter armor thing. It's just like, it's Star Wars clothes for Star Wars in-universe people.
Yeah.
What does that look like? That's what I want to make. And that's what I started doing before Galaxy's Edge was a thing. And then suddenly Galaxy's Edge was a thing. And now it's like the demand showed up from nowhere.
Bounding.
Like for this style of dressing. Because before this, it was like you did costumes of characters that were established, or you did like custom Mandos. There was no like, this is my custom scoundrel. No one did that.
Yeah, yeah.
Except
yeah.
me, because I have to have an entire closet for my character because I'm a lunatic. But now this like demand exists, and it's like, I want to be there for it because that's what I want to do. And I'm kind of already doing it. And now there's just the audience to do it even more. So,
yeah, that is I completely agree with that. I think you and I are kind of in that same, like, I feel like our customers are,
totally.
They're looking
going
together.
To the same place. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And so it's interesting that you're saying that because, you know, I'm going to Star Cruiser, right? So, you know, you're paying us whatever, you know, ridiculous amount of money to go to this stupid thing. And I think it's going to be amazing. But it's like, for most people, you're going to spend the money on it. And I'm in this, you know, the Star Wars Galactic Star Cruiser costuming Facebook group, you know, and people are so freaking creative about, you know, hey, a chef's coat has kind of off-kilter pieces, and like it doesn't just have a zip down the middle, because, you know, if you're an executive chef, you have to come out and talk to, you know, you can't just have a, you know, you're not wearing a hoodie in the back if you're, you know, cooking filet mignon. So like people are like repurposing chef coats, and like just they look, you know, people I think have kind of really become aware of the knickknacks of what makes Star Wars, you know. It's like, yeah,
the softer, less compelling pieces. Like I think the costuming community has known for a really long time that Han Solo's flat front smuggler shirt is a chef's shirt. Like, that's what it was. That's right. Where they got it from. But like, now there's suddenly this whole new audience that's like, everyone's after that damn shirt.
Yeah, yeah.
And they weren't before. Unless you were making literally a Han Solo, you didn't need shirt.
Yeah, and I have one like right here. I'm like looking at it. I'm like, yeah, you know, I bought that shirt. You're right. And what's really cool about it is I think that we've almost, and part of the conversation I've had with a lot of people, it's something that I think is so overlooked. It's like, if you were tasked with making background actors, right? Like you watch any of these shows and you think of like Canto Bight and The Last Jedi, or you think of, you know, even just in the background of like Book of Boba Fett, when he's walking through the town in Mos Eisley and, Mos Espa. And you have these like people that almost, some of them have the hats, and some of them have like, you know, head wraps. And there's always been kind of this, like, you know, George was obviously very inspired by like Middle Eastern, you know, design. And there's a lot of different themes going on. And I always think like those might actually be harder to make conceptually than hero armor or hero costumes, you know, because you got to make it look fit a silhouette, but it doesn't have all the greeblies and all this, you know.
There has to be like a level of mundaneness.
Yeah.
Without looking like it wasn't unthought through.
Right.
Like, it still has to be very particular. It still has to follow an aesthetic, and you have to do it with like bare bones.
Right. Right. I don't know. That's I'm interested because I have the Art of the Galaxy's Edge book, which for costuming, pick it up because it's really cool to see like their conceptual beginnings to what the cast members were going to wear.
Oh yeah, I'll need to pick that up. I have
you got to pick it up
about those costumes, but
in
maybe
some
the art book is more aspirational.
Well, you also got to think too, though. Like the amazing part of what they did for those costumes was like had to make. I mean, dang, you're talking fitting body sizes. Like there is a lot that, you know, again, what you're saying. Like we're talking about, like, you know, on screen, then they have to do this. Like you have to think that any person that walks in that wants to work at Galaxy's Edge has to be able to wear this costume, whatever it is. Right.
Mm-hmm. And be comfortable and be able to do their job in it still in Florida,
Yeah. And it's like way tougher than I think that initially, because yeah, same thing. Like they unveiled them and I remember people were like, oh, that's it. Like that's what you're going to wear. And then you kind of look at it and go, you got like, you're not even speaking to the middle of the class. You're talking to like the lowest portion of the class in terms of being like, we need to
accept
everything.
And like, I'll admit, I have not been yet to Galaxy's Edge. So I haven't actually experienced it in person. I've only seen like the photos and my initial like reaction to it. So like,
sure.
I've not had the experience yet where it's like I'm in the environment and I'm seeing how they all mesh and like the variations there are. But that'll be interesting. I am going for the first time during Star Wars Celebration coming up. I got tickets to the
Disney After Dark.
Yeah, the After Dark. And that's like how I want to experience it, where it's like the people who like this the most wearing the coolest costumes doing Galaxy's Edge. Like that's what I want to experience it with.
Okay, so May 26th.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, I'll see you there. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
We'll be there.
I'm gassed.
It'll be awesome. Well, I mean, Emma, I'm really geeked to be able to talk with you about this because I think the idea of, as we're kind of closing up here, you know, I'm excited. I would love to see you be able to tackle something that, and I don't know, are we allowed to talk about this? Like, basically, if you made a Star Wars inspired jacket set, something that wasn't crushed with logos and wasn't plastered with logos and all that kind of stuff on it, then I actually think, like, legally, you are like totally in the clear to be able to make something like that. And then at that point, you're building a brand that might be just besides Gabbercrete, and you're now in, you know, you're able to be picked up and hopefully, you know, locked into orders. And I think the part that people forget about, though, is that if you still want the jackets to be affordable, you got to buy a ton of those. And now you got, you know, now you are in distribution hell. You are in trying to figure out how to get them off a boat, over here, out of a warehouse. Where am I going to store all this stuff? How am I going to fulfill this stuff? You are suddenly a larger small business versus you just doing all the stuff yourself. It's very interesting. You think you've thought about this, I know, already.
Oh, yeah. No, I've taken, I'm taking baby steps. Baby steps towards smaller, bigger things to hopefully bigger, bigger things. And yeah, just kind of comfortable where I am right now and like, you know, continuing to march towards like bigger ideas so I can make more people happy.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm glad that I was able to get a little bit of a scoop here on Armor Party and figure out that the future might be bright. And if it's too bright, it's hopefully not the Death Star. So that's awesome. Well, Emma, you are such a talent. I'm so glad I was able to sit down and learn a little bit more about your story. I'm thrilled to see another costumer that's really making waves in this community, because I think all of the success and all of the excitement built around Gabbercrete is 100% earned, because you absolutely crush it with this. And I wish many, many, many exciting things for you in the future. I'm excited to hear that you're going to Celebration. It'll be really cool. We'll have to have a blue milk together. You can fill me in on all the new things that are going to be happening. But first, before we go, I have to push you through a lightning round. Is that fine?
Yes.
All right. Let's do it. Okay, Emma, you got to answer these questions somewhat quick, but at this point, we just like to talk about this stuff. Let me ask you, Emma, who has better costumes, the good guys or the bad guys?
You know, there's a right answer to this, because you don't have to actually have even seen Star Wars to know who Darth Vader and what Stormtrooper, like who Stormtroopers are. Like, it's iconic. It has broken through like international, like non-moviegoer understanding. So it is the bad guys, but I like the good guys. I'm a good guy person, so.
No, we're going with bad guys. You said it. That was the first answer you said. I'm loving that. So I know that you are a fan of all the extended stuff. What part of Legends of the EU do you want to see most brought into modern Star Wars?
That's a hard question, because
I'm sure that's why I asked it. That's why
it's hard to know where it even fits. You know, I would say that Dave Filoni's actually already done a lot of it. a lot of what I would have wanted. Bringing back Thrawn was really huge. Like, that's kind of all I can ask for right now. I don't know if there's anything else that I can point to and go, like, that would make it all better. Like, so the answer is probably Thrawn, and he's already done that. So I just want to see where they take him next, because I think we're probably going to see him again soon.
Oh, absolutely. Who has the best costume? Character, theme, whatever. Who has the best costume across the Star Wars saga?
I feel like that's another there's a right answer. Mm. Like, Padme. It's her. Everything is stunning. My favorite costume, personally, in all of Star Wars, though, is Luke's Bespin Dagobah jumpsuit.
Yeah.
The cut on that thing is just incredible.
Yeah, like, a little high.
No, I love that. You gotta have that 70s belly button waistband. Like, everything about it is good.
Sure, with the proper moccasins, and it just gets thrashed at the end of Clouds. I mean, just like, it's fried.
Yeah.
It's got grease all over it. It's just
I love every version. I love the version where he's has just the tank top and he's training with Yoda. I like when it's fresh and new. I like when it's absolutely trashed by Darth Vader. It's just a great costume.
Yeah. And everyone that I've had on this show that has kind of been more like fabric centric has said that line about Padme.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, I can totally tell if I'm going to have someone on here who knows how to use a sewing machine, they're going to say, I love Padme was just, I think it's Drew Hart said, he was like, Padme was just art.
Yeah. Just one of the first things you just fixate on. Like, I was obsessed with the Handmaidens when I was first getting into Star Wars, because it was like episode one times, and that velvet, maroon velvet number they wear at the end is just incredible.
Yeah, it's a thing. If you had the chance to design a new look for an established character, Emma, who would you pick to redesign?
Oh, man. I don't know if I've never thought about that.
Well, you're welcome to the armor party.
I don't know. Probably I would take a crack at Sabine, just because...
That's logical.
Yeah, because I didn't love her when she first showed up.
Okay.
And I still don't know if I super love those. I've grown to love them because I'm so familiar with them, but I would love to take a stab at Sabine's armor. And honestly, now that I'm thinking about it, I would take another go at Mando's. I don't love Mando's armor. I think it is too far away from the source material.
Okay.
And I think we need to get back into classic Mandalorian silhouettes more. So I might redesign Mando because he's kind of the face of Star Wars right now. And I think it's important.
Okay. All right. That's an answer. I can't wait for the comments on that one. That's going to be great. People are nice and spicy. Either they love all Mr. Shiny, or either they want to say, I need to put a little in. Yeah.
I think his armor could use a little bit of something different.
All right. Well, hey, that's what people tune in for the hot takes. That's it.
Yeah. They can DMs.
And I'm sure they will.
I'll fight them.
That's it. That's right. I know, right? You're like, yeah, go ahead and send them. I'm already expecting you. Are you a blaster or a lightsaber kind of gal?
Blaster. I think everyone starts out as a lightsaber person because that's like the cool part when you're first getting into Star Wars and you're usually younger. And then like as you grow up, you start to appreciate the more scoundrelly, like, gray type characters, and you end up in blaster land. So, yeah, probably blaster.
All right, so you don't trust those hokey religions and ancient weapons. You're a trusty blaster at your side, kind of a scoundrel yourself. What blaster, though? I gotta ask, like, what blaster do you, if you could pick, like, what do you pick?
I feel like it has multiple names depending on where you look, but that long-barreled version of the Naboo blaster, that Q2 that like Padme always uses.
Yeah.
Not the snub-nose version. That one isn't as cool. The long barrel one. That's the ticket. It makes a really cool sound. It looks really neat. And I'm not really a weapons person, so that's all I know about it, is that it sounds cool and it looks neat.
Sure. And it's almost like, I love that blaster for so many reasons, because like that was, you're going from like a German machine gun that the sand troopers had in Tunisia. And then you like Flash Gordon it and go back to like, whoa, wacky sci-fi. And you give Padme that blaster. And I'm sure that there was someone that just got so angry about that. They're like, what the heck is she at? I'm like, I love that you picked that. I think that's a great, that's a great choice.
And like, honestly, I think I was also very young when those movies came out. So like, less offends me about them than like people who were living it in the moment, because like, it's just always kind of been there for me. So like, I can understand why it would make other people upset.
Yeah, but Star Wars for everyone, isn't that our whole thing? Is like, I mean, think about it. If some of the fandom at the time would have had their way about the backlash over The Phantom Menace, you might not have been inspired enough to do what you're doing now. Like,
yeah.
To me, I'm kind of like, that's why we got to remember that, like, kids, you know what I mean? Like, here's the thing. I took a friend of ours, he's like 10 years old, right? Go to see Rogue One. We watched Rogue One. He thought the Vader scene was crazy, but like Rogue One, he didn't think it was that cool. He thought the X-Wings were awesome, but he didn't think it was that cool. We came home, watched Clone Wars, and he geeked. He's like, oh, yeah, I love Clone Wars. It's awesome. And so it's kind of like, you know, hashtag not my Star Wars. It's like, yeah, get in line. Everybody has their Star Wars.
I mean, every generation has their Star Wars, so I can understand that. You know, I was growing up during the prequels, so I still remember them fondly. I can like understand the critiques with them, but
sure,
yeah, so much of the aesthetic of the prequel trilogy is still like so good.
Yeah, and that it all ended up in animated stuff.
Yeah,
you know, like if the original, I don't know if you know this, the, you know, Mother Talzin was the original Maul.
Oh, like from the old art book. Yeah, that brings up like a concept art in my mind.
Yeah, because I have the, if you get a chance, because Tash and the publisher just had the art, or like the have you seen that book, that like humongous the Star Wars?
Have seen that book, but I do not have that book. I want that book.
Okay, this book, they have a shortened version of it, but like it's got all the concept art of like the original.
Oh, I love that image of Padme. I had that saved in a notebook for so long.
Yeah. So prequels,
their art direction was so
incredible.
Good. Like, you can
Doug
say
Chang,
what you
legend.
Yeah, I feel like people can say what they have to say about like the plot and like how, you know, George was starting to go off the rails, and I feel like those things are valid. But like, as an art direction separate from the OT, where it doesn't like negate the art direction of the OT, it's like wonderful.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's what we could talk. We'll talk about it at Celebration. Emma, if you could retire to one planet in Star Wars, where would it be?
Probably Naboo. It just seems pleasant. All other planets aren't super pleasant.
Yeah.
If I were my character, I'd probably go somewhere more dangerous. But if it were just me, I would need to go to Naboo because I would not survive.
Sure, that's fine. Yeah, Naboo seems to have a nice balance of lots of things, right? Mm-hmm. It has a nice ecosystem. It seems to look rather peaceful. How would you get there? How would you get to Naboo? What ship would you take in Star Wars to get to Naboo?
Oh, ships are another thing that don't really get me going, because I'm not like a vehicles person. But like, okay. I'll probably go again to like just Naboo ships, and like now the N1 is like hot off the presses again, and I'm like, that one, or like one of her like silver senatorial ships where it's like N1 but big, like those are neat. Yeah. I like those.
All chromed out. Yeah.
I had the essential guide, the new essential guide to ships, and for some reason I was always obsessed with the Jabatha because it just looked so different from all the other ships.
Sure.
Like that sort of sentient Vong like character ship. Don't love the green, but just loved the lines.
Yeah.
On that ship.
Sure. Let me ask you this last question here. Which of the modern Star Wars projects, I know you have your opinions on modern Star Wars, but of all of these projects that are on the docket, which of the modern Star Wars projects are you most excited for?
Upcoming?
Yeah.
Is this for upcoming?
Yeah.
Ahsoka, because that's going to be the, like, the same way that Star Wars Rebels was just a sequel to the Clone Wars. I feel like the Ahsoka show is going to be the sequel to Rebels. And that's the story I'm following at this point. Like, I want to see what Thrawn's up to. I want to know what him and Ezra have been getting up to, because they're going to be besties now. Like, they're going to be, that's going to bring Sabine back on the screen, and it's just going to be this like girl gang show. I hope Rex shows up. Like, that's where the meat's going to be, and that's probably where the majority of Filoni's focus is also going to be, and he is, like, he gets to do the best stuff, so.
He's our guy, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm the most excited for.
Do you think we're going to see a Purrgil in live action?
Yeah, especially if Filoni's in charge. He loves his critters.
That's true. This is very true. Well, thank you, Emma, for being on Armor Party. I'm so happy to be able to share your work and share your talent and share your passion for Star Wars. It's evident, of course, in everything that you make, but I'm glad that I was able to have a conversation with you and learn more about where you kind of started in this whole thing and where you fit within this incredible costuming community. Where can people find you? Where's the best way for people to follow along with not only just your incredible commissions, but also like the epic photos your husband takes of you in awesome armor?
Yeah, probably like Instagram is where I post like everything right now. I have my my Gabber Creep profile, and then I have my Robo Emma profile where I do all of my costuming. And like you said, my husband is the real Lucas McCoy, and he posts amazing Star Wars photography of not just me. So like, I love the sort of stuff that we're able to like pump out together. Like, that's very fun just to like keep making Star Wars.
Yeah, well, I love that. And you guys do it well, so keep it up. I'm a fan. I love seeing two people make amazing things. So I'm looking forward to meeting you at Celebration. Any last words? Anything you want to tell the people before we sign off?
Not really. Just thanks for having me on. This was really fun. I love getting to talk about what I enjoy. That's just like always a treat. So.
Well, that's what we're here for. Well, Emma, may the Force be with you, and I'm looking forward to seeing what's coming down the line. And that concludes one heck of a conversation here on Armor Party. You know, I'm thrilled to be able to bring Emma's story to other costumers. I'm so excited to hear what she's going to bring to this community in the next few years. So give her work a follow. Find her at GabberCrete on Instagram and let her know you enjoyed her appearance on the show. You know, there's a lot happening in the next few weeks. I'm going to switch over to some more casual Batu background character building until our trip to the Star Cruiser is over. So Armor Party will be taking a very short break, but we've got some amazing guests lined up in the queue. So do not worry, we'll be back in action soon enough. We applied to be a panelist at Celebration, and we'll hear back early March if we get accepted or not. So we're crossing our fingers that they accept. Send good vibes through the Force for us. We've got a really cool show. I'm super excited if it comes through. It'll have some familiar faces, so we're crossing our fingers. I will be on the After School Radio Show with Blink-182 bass player Mark Hoppus talking a brief overview on his thoughts of Book of Boba Fett next Tuesday. You can find that at the After School Radio Show on iTunes. And we'll keep building towards May and all the amazing things we have going on at Celebration in Anaheim. Armor Party is a part of the Thank the Maker Network. Thank the Maker is a more generalized Star Wars podcast run by some friends of mine in some pretty popular bands. So make sure you give them a follow if you're looking for more generic Star Wars. You can find them at Thank the Maker Pod on Instagram and Twitter. Our sister podcast, Princess and Scoundrel, is more focused on Disney park going. If you've got a family, if you're looking to go to the parks by yourself and have a real cool Star Wars experience, our friend Sarah Maciel booked our trip to the Star Cruiser. And there's so much content that's about to start coming out about it. So if you are looking to book your trip, make sure you reach out to her. She'll make your experience completely easy. And best of all, it's free of charge. Disney pays her. You don't pay her a cent. So find their show at Princess and Scoundrel Show on Instagram and also YouTube. Our incredible theme music and production is done by my friend Alton James. He is a talented composer, an amazing audio engineer. So if you're looking for an original theme song for your podcast or for your Star Wars fan film, even non-Star Wars projects, hit him up. Find him at Alton_James on Instagram. Once again, I am your host, Mike Forrester, wishing you happy builds, clean paint jobs, and always remember, being an adult is boring, but building Star Wars costumes is anything but.
everything is proceeding as I have foreseen.